This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. 2021 is on track to be California's worst wildfire season yet. That's after 2020 was the largest wildfire season ever. And before that, it was 2018. You know, for years, the state has faced criticism for failing to prevent worsening fire conditions. One solution you often hear proposed? Prescribed burns.
We're trying now to do that.
Here's Governor Gavin Newsom speaking about it last April.
That requires efforts to do prescribed burns. It requires efforts to get mechanical equipment out into the forest to prepare for those prescribed burns.
Prescribed burns are fires set by firefighters themselves in areas that can be contained. A small controlled fire can actually prevent a bigger fire from finding fuel and spinning out of control. And they're widely viewed in California as a good idea, a change after 100 years of putting out every single fire in a rural area. Take a listen to this tape. It's from an interview that KCRW did in Malibu last year with a guy named George Cisno. He's a plumber who was helping to rebuild a Malibu home that burned in the 2018 Woolsey fire.
The smartest thing you could ever do. If they could do controlled burns, they wouldn't have any problems. If you burn it, you don't have a problem.
That's conventional wisdom, right? But some Southern Californians living in fire-prone areas don't want to see their properties set aflame in a controlled burn. And actually, some fire ecologists say they're right to feel that way. Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells has this story on prescribed burns and why you don't see more of them in Southern California.
Marty Witter is sitting beneath a mature California black walnut tree in a Calabasas park, a few minutes from where she lives. The hillside behind her burned in 2003, and then it burned again in 2016.
Oh, everywhere in the Santa Monica Mountains is fire prone. Basically, anywhere you have native vegetation is fire prone.
She's a fire ecologist working in the Santa Monica Mountains. She says the last drought was so severe, many of the native trees that should have started to grow back by now don't have the water they need to survive.
So what we're looking at here is a combination of two fires and a long-term, an extreme long-term drought. So it's just become worse.
She says today, burn scars in grasslands can become flammable again in as little as 2 to 4 years. So introducing prescribed burns to this landscape won't make it any less flammable.
This is an ecosystem that's really adapted to infrequent fire. So it is fire adapted, but probably the natural return interval in this area would have been between 70 and 100 years because this is one of the areas with the lowest amount of lightning ignitions in the country. Overall,
the vast majority of fires sparked here aren't sparked naturally like lightning. They're human caused, like a downed power line or a misplaced campfire.
So it's an irreconcilable problem. If you eliminate the fuel load in chaparral, you've eliminated the habitat. If it does burn too frequently, then you in fact begin to lose those native shrub species that are the glue that holds the community together.
And you get non-native species that grow in their place that also happen to be more flammable, like the golden rolling grass hills that California is known for. Witter says there is evidence of indigenous burning practices, but the landscape is already so different than it was hundreds of years ago. As fire agencies figure out how or whether to burn safely, they've faced calls to collaborate with indigenous people who say they've known how to safely engage with fire for generations. That pressure has come from federal and local politicians, from residents living in fire-prone areas, and from Native Americans themselves.
Notun Ipakushmak Yaka Atachi, Notun Richard Bugby Yaka. My name's Richard Bugby. I'm a Luceño, Waneño, Yaki, Kuya, a bunch of other stuff.
Richard Bugby is also an ethnobotanist and a culture bearer, meaning he knows a lot about plants and the purposes they serve to Native people living in Southern California. He says fire is in every part of local indigenous cultures, from safety to dance rituals to making basket weaving materials easier to use. His greeting literally translates as, "May the fire within you keep burning."
In Champtala, there's a word fire, which is yute, and then there's a word for a forest fire, which translates into fire that burns itself. And then we have another word for fire, which is japena. But japena is a word for fire, meaning you light the fire in several places in a circle and let it burn to the center.
Although policymakers throughout California often refer to Native Americans setting fires deliberately, actual records of cultural burning in Southern California are sparse, partly because indigenous tribes were forced to relocate after the Spanish arrived. Culture bearers like Bugby rely heavily on oral tradition to remember what practices existed here. He wants to see more collaboration between fire agencies and local tribes, but he says whatever burning does happen here would be much less frequent than in Northern California.
Our forest down here, I think of our forest as a chaparral. It, you know, it's not just not trees, it's just real thick woody bushes. Every once in a while that had to be burnt a little bit, but really long intervals between it.
Angeles National Forest Fire Chief Robert Garcia says prescribed burns aren't unheard of in the forests of Southern California. They're just rare and getting more difficult to do safely.
We've had some significant challenges this year, this prescribed burn season, if you will, which is typically, you know, January through May, because of how dry things have been. We really had to slow down, you know, in order to manage the risk of any kind of escape.
Fire agencies have to choose days when the plants aren't too dry and the wind isn't too strong so they can maintain control of a prescribed burn. As the climate warms and the drought worsens, that window of opportunity has gotten smaller. That's left some local residents skeptical about whether prescribed burn works in Southern California at all. Goat farmer Gloria Putnam and her partner live on 70 acres on the northern edge of the Angeles National Forest. She lives in the scar of the Bobcat Fire, which burned last summer.
I had really no expectation that it was going to make it all the way to this side of the mountain. And it wasn't until about a little bit more than 24 hours before the fire arrived here that the fire guys came and told us that we needed to get out.
Firefighters saved her home and barn, but a lot of her land is now a moonscape of barren hills dotted with black, dead tree trunks.
When we got back, we were just so happy to be home, and we didn't feel the grief yet. And I think we were kind of high on adrenaline and probably kind of in shock.
It took a couple months for her losses to sink in. With much of the foraging land gone, they started feeding the goats hay. That cost them an extra $4,000 per month. They took donations and ran up their credit cards to keep their goats fed. But she said the most emotional part was realizing what they'll never get back.
Studying about how land in an arid environment like this recovers, I learned that the pinyon pines, you know, there won't be a forest here in my lifetime. Like, I won't see that recovery. It might recover, but I'm not going to be here to see it. So, yeah, thinking about the loss of all that forage, it was like someone died, you know, of all those trees.
Putnam says some of those trees were more than 100 years old, so she doesn't like the idea of introducing prescribed fire onto her property. She can't find evidence of fires burning on most of her property since records began in the 19th century. So why should they start happening now?
Well, they don't make sense in Southern California, so it's not really a question for me. So in Chaparral, there's only one kind of fire. It's landscape replacing. It, you know, it burns intensely. It burns everything. There's no such thing as a controlled burn in a chaparral. When there's fire, it's complete. Mm-hmm. And that's just the nature of this ecosystem.
That's what happened here last year. But now, a rebirth.
So it's true that the pinyon pines are gone for a long time. And that is sad. I'm sad that they're gone. But there is also a whole new thing that's going to happen on this land that hasn't happened in hundreds of years. That's incredible in terms of biodiversity and totally different than what I've seen. So now I feel more like, what an incredible opportunity to be here now to get to see that.
Her goat herd is a little smaller, but they're foraging again, grazing from the new growth in last year's burn scar and helping to spread the seeds of a new generation of California wildlife. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Well, that was just one of several stories that Kaylee's working on concerning another potentially record-breaking fire season. And Kaylee joins me right now to talk about how you can help in her future reporting. Hi, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
So you've been reaching out for questions about wildfire season, and this is going to help inform where you go with your reporting. What are some of the things that you're hearing?
Yeah, so we've actually gotten dozens of questions so far, and almost all of them fall into three main themes. There are people who want to know about protecting against poor air quality, which is going to affect everybody, regardless of if you're in a fire-prone area. People want to know how to help prevent fire, and then we're also getting questions about our systems, like, why is my insurance dropping me, or why is our infrastructure so good at sparking wildfire?
Well, let's key in on that insurance drop. And there was one particular question that apparently struck you.
Yeah, we got a listener in South Pasadena who's lived there for 25 plus years. And even though she lives in suburban South Pasadena, where she's never had to worry about evacuating, her home insurance policy just dropped her. So now she has these questions about, why are they all of a sudden calling me a high-risk area? Is that definition changing? I don't know any of the answers to these questions, but I would love to find out for her.
Something that you're going to pursue, obviously. What's the next thing that you're going to talk about, though, when it comes to wildfires?
Well, this week I am talking to an insurance expert, hopefully to get advice for people like the one in South Pasadena. I'm also going to get the latest tips for home hardening from firefighters, and I am investigating encampment fires in Topanga Canyon, so look out for those answers soon. And by the way, fire season's just starting, so it is not too late to send me your questions.
And you can do that by calling this number and leaving a message. Just leave a voicemail. It's area code 424-538-8581. That's 424-538-8581. Or you can ask your question at our website. Here's a simple URL to remember, kcrw.com/askgreaterla. kcrw.com/askgreaterla. KCRW's Kaylee Wells. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, as we move on now with Greater LA, let's talk about another way that California fights its wildfires, with the work of certain people who are serving time in jails and prisons. So-called incarcerated firefighters make up just under a third of the crews who are on the front lines trying to prevent and contain wildfires. A new book highlights the stories of several women who, while serving their sentences, also fight fires. Breathing Fire chronicles the dangerous jobs that they have in areas all around California at a time when wildfires seem to be happening more than ever. And the book's author, Jamie Lowe, is with me right now. Jamie, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You talk about this job, and, you know, being a firefighter is a life-threatening, perilous one. They are wearing pounds of protective gear and carrying chainsaws and buckets to clear brush. Why would someone who is incarcerated want to put themselves through this? I mean, do they get paid better for being on the front lines of fighting fire here in California?
Sure. There are many reasons why people would want to be part of this program. One is that it's one of the highest paid jobs within the prison industries for state prisons. That's not to say it's a very well-paid job compared to civilian crews. It's still, you know, they get paid, when I started reporting, they got paid $2.56 a day, and now it's up to $5 a day. And when they're out there on the front lines fighting fire, they get paid about $1 to $2 an hour. Another reason that people want to go to the prison fire camps is that the conditions are just exponentially better than state prisons and county jails. You have situations where there are trees, there are no fences, there's no barbed wire. It's sort of these beautiful, you know, remote areas where you're immersed in nature. You have to do really, really, really hard, perilous labor, but you're in a much more beautiful place serving time. There's also better food. There's better food and your families can visit the places that, you know, that you can rent a cabin and have your family stay overnight. Sometimes you can hug your families. There was a woman that I talked with recently who was a formerly incarcerated firefighter who described seeing her kid in prison. And when she was in state prison, it was just her hand pressed up against a plexiglass window and her child pressed up against the window. And that was as close to contact as she could get with her child. But when she was in the camps, they could hug each other.
How'd you get access to these firefighters?
Well, when I decided to write about Shauna Lynn Jones, who was the firefighter who lost her life fighting a fire, the Mulholland Fire in 2016, I contacted CDCR, the Corrections Department in California, and I asked if I could write about the program. And they said that I could go to the camps. They said I could go to the training facility at CIW, which is a state prison where the crews are trained. And I ended up going to all three female camps.
Shauna died while fighting a fire in Malibu. Can you give us sort of the, you know, the circumstances around her death?
Sure. So she was about 45 days away from the end of her prison sentence. And she had, you know, really, she had really grown to thrive off of the work and really connected with the forestry work and wanted to continue it when she was released. And she was out on this fire. It was the last fire with the foreman who was working with them, and he wanted her to try out a saw. They were out on the fire. It wasn't an extraordinarily, you know, scary fire. It was about 10 acres in the hills in Malibu. And they went in cutting line, and the mountains of Malibu, the granite, the sand, the terrain is such that it's really rocky territory. It's really rough. And at one point there were pebbles that started falling and a boulder fell and hit her in the head, and she was unconscious. And her crew members, they saw her kind of turn white, and blood came out of her ears and her eyes. And she eventually was airlifted to UCLA. And then she was taken off of life support a few days later.
Yeah, you write about her mom coming to see her at the hospital. It was just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
There was another woman in your book named Alicia who'd gone to prison for a half dozen burglaries. She's been addicted to methamphetamine, but while she was serving her time, she'd trained for the firefighting program. Tell us a little bit about Alicia.
So Alicia, I met her when she was in camp, the first time that we met in person, and she felt totally transformed by the program. She is a single mom. She was ready to try and translate the skills that she was learning into a job, which she could then, you know, be a mom and be there for her daughter. And she got out of prison and she, you know, felt like there wasn't a lot of support. She tried to volunteer for crews. She tried to participate. You know, a few months went by, she ended up relapsing, and she was part of another burglary where it was a nonviolent burglary. She broke a window and she ended up running away from the house. And it was a literal broken window situation, but it was her third strike. And so her case went to trial and she was sentenced 26 years to life, and she went back to prison, and she's now in Chowchilla, you know, waiting to see. She appealed the sentence, and she's waiting to see how long she's going to have to serve.
Why do you think, I mean, this is fascinating to me. If you're a firefighter when you're incarcerated, California does not, for some reason, invest in this, in a pipeline. You mentioned she wanted to go get a job as a firefighter after she left prison. You would think that the state would want to invest to get, you know, to reduce recidivism, just reduce, you know, so people aren't lured back into what got them in trouble in the first place. Why do you think that is? Why isn't there a pipeline for these women to get a job firefighting once they're out of prison?
I mean, I can't speak for CDCR because there are so many questions I have about the ways in which the system works and doesn't work, and largely doesn't work in my mind. And so it's very hard for me to explain lots of it. I mean, at the very base level, when you mention recidivism rates, they don't even keep track of the recidivism rates of the fire program. So while they're very proud of it and they point to it as a really successful rehabilitation program, there's actually no data to support it. So that's the baseline, is to know exactly how it works. And then beyond that, you know, in terms of utilizing the training and getting people, you know, men and women who have trained as firefighters and want to continue the work, that's a system-wide problem in terms of supporting people in reentry. I think it's not just with incarcerated firefighters and formerly incarcerated firefighters. It's getting people work when they're out and getting people supported when they're out and making sure that they can reenter society in a way that isn't, you know, full of hurdles.
You grew up here in California, right? And I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading a part of your book about fighting fires in California, but I guess how central fires are in California. This is from pages 54 and 55.
If you live in California or are lucky enough to be from there, fire is a constant backdrop. It defines the evolving surface of the state, leaving forests naked and mountain ranges blackened, communities decimated, and vineyards and orchards scorched. Extreme fires used to be once a decade events. I remember the 1991 fire in the Oakland Hills. Growing up, we had a Christmas card of family, friends on our fridge, posed in front of what used to be their house. Just the fence remained. I was born in Oakland, and it was shocking to see homes in the Bay Area leveled, the ground blackened. Now fires in California are year-round. Or as author Stephen J. Pine puts it, fire season lasts 13 months. Fires burn hotter, faster, and longer than they ever did. And because of climate change, invasive plant species, invasive beetles, and massive housing developments in high-risk fire zones, those fires are more damaging to structures, species, and human lives.
I wonder, after writing this book, Jamie, has your perspective of the state changed? Do you think it's, I mean, when you think, I mean, a Christmas card of pictures of people standing in front of their decimated, you know, burned down homes, that's pretty macabre.
It is. And it's certainly, you know, there are so many things about California right now that are terrifying. You know, there's the prediction of mega floods that are supposed to come in within 10 years. There's mega droughts, which we're in. There's mega fires, which are happening right now. You know, I think there's a more than 200,000 acre fire happening at this moment and keeps growing and jumping fire lines. There is a lot of catastrophe unfolding every single day. And it's terrifying. And I think that that's not even counting, you know, this sort of societal and spiritual crisis of mass incarceration, which CDCR is one of the biggest prison industries and prison systems in the country. And that's a lot of people that are imprisoned.
What did you learn from the female firefighters that you spent all that time with and that you wrote about?
Well, I learned everything that I know about fire is from them. I've talked with tons of fire experts and different captains and firemen and firewomen, and I think ultimately hearing their very specific experiences on the fire line brought it to high relief for me, because I could really feel the emotional stake of what they went through. I also just learned about them as people, and I think ultimately when I'm writing, that's my goal, is I want to get to know people and I want to know who they are and what they've gone through.
Jamie Lowe, who wrote the book Breathing Fire, which, by the way, is out now. Jamie, congratulations. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
That's it for this evening. Tomorrow on the show, the COVID surge is real. What does that mean for schools and hospitals? That's tomorrow on GLA. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great night.